the U.S. announces $8 billion in aid for Ukraine.
We show Ukrainians you're not alone.
Israel prepares for a ground offensive in Lebanon after more airstrikes.
The country's army chief told troops the strikes were meant to prepare for a possible ground operation.
And empowering girls in Cape Town.
Hi, my name is Cindy Limavunja, and I'm the bicycle mayor of Cape Town.
Today is Thursday, September 26th.
And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strope.
I'm determined to ensure the Ukraine has what it needs to prevail in its fight for survival.
The United States plans to announce more than $8 billion worth of military assistance for Ukraine on Thursday during Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to Washington.
This war has shown the Ukrainians can do anything they set their minds to. Today, we show the Ukrainians you're not alone. You're not alone in this fight.
On Wednesday, the U.S., Britain, and the EU also announced support for Ukraine's reconstruction after the war. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
And I'm pleased to confirm that Europe will be providing up to 35 billion euros. This loan will be repaid by the windfall profits of the immobilized Russian assets. In other words, it is Russia who pays for the damages it caused.
Ukrainian President Zelensky was at the gathering.
After the devastating Second World War, the Allies launched the Marshall Plan, which gave peace the strength to become truly lasting. And today we are laying the foundation for a similar architecture of recovery, one that will promote peace for Ukraine and all of Europe and the general welfare.
Former President Donald Trump described Ukraine in bleak and mournful terms Wednesday, referring to its people as dead and the country itself as demolished, and further raised questions about how much the former president would be willing, if elected again, to concede in a negotiation over the country's future.
The president of Ukraine is in our country, and he's making little nasty aspersions toward your favorite president, me. But take a look at the war happening right now in Ukraine. It would have never happened if I were president to start off with. And there didn't even have to be a settlement. It wouldn't have happened, period. Russia wouldn't have gone in. I spoke to Putin about it a lot.
He's referring to a comment that President Zelensky made about not believing that Trump could end the war in 24 hours, as he claims. Trump argued Ukraine should have made concessions to Russian President Vladimir Putin in the months before Russia's February 2022 attack, declaring that even the worst deal would have been better than what we have now.
Let's say we did settle and a deal would have been made with Russia years ago, 3 years ago, before it all began. And we could have made a deal easily. Could have made it easily. If we had a president who was intelligent, we could have made a deal easily.
Trump on Wednesday accused President Zelensky of refusing to make a deal to end the war. Trump said, quote, "We continue to give billions of dollars to a man who refuses to make a deal," unquote. He made the comments at a campaign rally. The fact is, there is no deal on the table for peace, nor have there been substantive talks between Russia and Ukraine to make a deal.
The Israeli army chief says the military is preparing for a possible ground operation in Lebanon. He made the statement Wednesday as Hezbollah hurled dozens of projectiles into Israel, including a missile aimed at Tel Aviv. The latest now from Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
A Reuters camera captured the moment an Israeli airstrike hit a target in the coastal Lebanese city of Tyre on Wednesday. Israel has widened its airstrikes in Lebanon against Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants. In a video released by the Israeli military, the country's army chief told troops the strikes were meant to prepare for a possible ground operation. Even as he spoke, high-level diplomats pushed to stop the fighting in both Gaza and Lebanon. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
With regard to Lebanon, we've been working tirelessly with partners to avoid a full-blown war. and to move to a diplomatic process that would allow Israelis and Lebanese alike to go back to their homes.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer called on the UN Security Council to pull the sides back from the brink of war.
We need an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Lebanese Hezbollah and the implementation of a political plan which allows Israeli and Lebanese civilians to return to their homes to live in peace and security.
Israeli airstrikes have targeted Hezbollah leaders and hit hundreds of sites deep inside Lebanon. Lebanese hospitals have filled with the wounded since Monday. Lebanon's health minister said at least 51 people were killed and at least 223 wounded in Wednesday's strikes. Hezbollah rocket fire since October has forced hundreds of thousands of Israelis to flee the border region. Israeli authorities said northern Israel was hit by heavy Hezbollah barrages on Wednesday morning. Three Israeli sources said the United States and France were working on ceasefire proposals to resolve the escalating fighting in Lebanon, but that so far no significant progress had been made.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The president of the Dominican Republic has warned that his administration would take drastic measures to protect the country if a UN-backed mission in neighboring Haiti targeting gang violence fails. He made the comment at the UN.
A U.S. federal judge has ordered the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to further regulate fluoride in drinking water because high levels could pose a risk to the intellectual development of children.
A Tunisian court sentenced presidential candidate Diachi Zamel to 6 months in prison for charges of falsifying documents, according to his lawyers who talked to the news service Reuters. The second prison sentence against him in a week, days before the presidential election.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 presidential election, early voting for the presidential election in the state of Georgia begins October 15th. Polls show a close contest there between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. VOA's Kane Farabaugh has more from Atlanta.
Georgia Governor Brian Kemp and vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance shared the stage at a recent dinner, a show of Republican Party unity, after years of discord between Kemp and former President Donald Trump.
We're finna start all over.
Atlanta voter Dorothy Harp is not concerned about Trump's feud with Kemp over the 2020 election, which Trump falsely says he won in Georgia. She's more concerned about the economy.
We had lower prices on our food, gas, energy. Because everything was better under Trump administration.
It's a message Harp takes door to door, encouraging members of her community to vote.
And I've got a lot of young voters who said they're going to vote for Trump.
In the 2020 election, Joe Biden defeated Trump in Georgia by just over 11,000 votes out of nearly 5 million cast. Numbers Georgia's Republican Governor Kemp knows well, as he implored audience members, including Harp, to vote.
So we cannot take anything for granted. We cannot take our foot off the gas.
Georgia is fully in play again.
Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens, a Democrat, says polls show another close race this year between Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris.
People sometimes get disenfranchised by thinking that their vote doesn't matter, but we have to go out there and make sure everyone knows that their vote does matter.
Listen, every vote counts.
Elijah Grace is with the voter advocacy organization, the New Georgia Project Action Fund, whose workers go door to door to promote voter registration.
We specialize in targeting black and brown people across the state, making sure that they have all the resources that's needed to cast their ballot.
A 2020 Pew Research Center study showed Georgia's eligible black voting population made up a third of the state's total electorate. Exit polls in 2020 showed 88% of black voters chose Biden. But recent polls show Democrats losing ground in this close contest.
Both sides understand that Rose lead through Georgia.
When the race was between Biden and Trump, Grace noticed a lack of enthusiasm among potential voters.
And since the Democratic ticket has changed, we have seen a strong uptick in support for Vice President Kamala Harris.
She's at the intersection of color and gender.
Bernice King, daughter of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., believes Harris appeals to voters previously considering sitting on the sidelines.
Frankly, just speaking as a woman, You know, I think this is a season where we're seeing more and more women emerge in the critical places of leadership.
Leadership is motivating Harp to back Trump, and she's working to bring others along with her as Republicans focus on inflation and cost of living concerns.
I have already committed to taking some of the people I know to the poll. I said, if you ain't got a way to get there, I'll get you there.
Polls open in Georgia for early voting on October 15th. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Atlanta.
As cases of Mpox continue to rise across the African continent, public health experts and world leaders are sounding the alarm and say more needs to be done to contain the outbreak. So far, 15 African countries are affected. We get the latest now from VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief, Mariama Diallo.
While the number of confirmed Mpox cases in countries like Kenya is low at 7 reported cases, the same can't be said about other nations. So far, 15 countries in Africa are assessed as having active outbreaks of Mpox, including the latest to report a case, Morocco. Samuel Bolan is the Mpox Incident Manager for the World Health Organization Regional Office for Africa. He says that while the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi account for almost 90% of confirmed cases, more instances are popping up in other countries. He spoke with VOA from Brazzaville in the Republic of Congo.
DRC and Burundi especially affected, but also Cameroon, Central African Republic, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, Republic of Congo, Liberia, Uganda, Kenya, Gabon, Rwanda, South Africa, and Guinea.
The WHO says two distinct clades or strains have been identified. They are clade 1, formerly known as the Congo Basin clade, and clade 2, the former West African clade. Formerly known as monkeypox, the viral disease can spread between people through close contact, according to the World Health Organization, and occasionally via objects and areas that have been touched by a person with Mpox. Signs and symptoms include fever, rash, and swollen lymph nodes. Bolan says that so far this year, there have been 6,580 confirmed cases, but there is a bigger number of suspected cases, meaning the ones that meet the case definition and are clinically compatible with Mpox, but may or may not have been tested due to various limitations in several countries. That number has climbed to nearly 32,000.
Now, amongst that larger number of suspected cases, 844 people have died, but when focusing on the confirmed cases, this year, as in from the 1st of January, 32 people have unfortunately passed away.
In a virtual briefing last week, Jean Kaseya, Director General of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says Mpox is not under control in Africa. He says that while vaccine donations are trickling in, the amount is insufficient to contain this outbreak. A view echoed by Boland.
Today, we have almost around 4 million commitment of doses. 4 million doses as commitment. But we say we need more.
In an address to world leaders at the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday, U.S. President Joe Biden highlighted the need to move quickly to confront the Mpox outbreak in Africa.
We're prepared to commit $500 million to help African countries prevent and respond to Mpox and to donate 1 million doses of Mpox vaccine. Now,
no specific date was given as to when all the vaccines will arrive in Africa, but Biden says these investments will be delivered bilaterally through existing relationships with partner countries, as well as through multilateral institutions. In addition to vaccines, Bolan says this Mpox outbreak requires interventions across the full spectrum of the public health sector. He says the world needs to scale up and make sure it can deliver in several areas.
Things like surveillance, which would include case investigation and contact tracing, both going out into communities and looking for cases, and also encouraging and working with communities to report cases when people become unwell.
He also says this approach includes infection prevention and control, case management, and vaccination. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Japanese lawmakers will choose a new prime minister Friday. That's when the governing Liberal Democratic Party votes on a new prime minister to replace Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. VOA's Seoul bureau chief William Gallo sat down to talk with U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel.
Ambassador Rahm Emanuel, thanks for talking to VOA.
Sure.
I'm going to start with a couple big picture questions, first of all. Especially under Prime Minister Kishida, Japan has taken a much more proactive, assertive role in the world. It's also more serious about its own defense. What do you think is responsible for that new approach, or sort of the intensification of that approach? And will that continue when Japan gets a new prime minister here in the next couple weeks?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose starting at the back end, I don't think it will change. Obviously, each prime minister in the cabinet will bring a different emphasis, but the core thrust and the core principles will stay. I think, to quote Prime Minister Kishida, if you want an insight into what he's thinking, he said it at the Shangri-La conference about 3 years ago, which is Ukraine today could be the Indo-Pacific tomorrow. And he realized that the way Japan was positioned needed to be updated, reformed, modernized, and invested in. That explains taking on 1% for GDP for defense to 2%, and they're in year three and they're holding steady and they'll get there, of which 99% of the money goes to equipment. It doesn't go to people, personnel. Fundamentally different than how we do it. Number two, they acquired counter-strike capability, 450 Tomahawks. Number three, they rewrote their national security documents. Number four, they lifted the exports on defense equipment, the restrictions to allow them to export to third-party countries that aren't in conflicts, which helps build a defense industry. And number five, they normalized their relationship with Korea, which is and that they've also done certain things with the Philippines that have kind of complemented and reinforced our transition to a lattice work away from a kind of like a hub and spoke system. And so I think you look at the world and they realize the way they were positioned was not effective enough to meet the challenges that they saw on the horizon. And it's one of the most fundamental rewrites of Japan's kind of security posture and diplomatic posture in the region since World War II.
So when you talk about regional challenges, obviously one of the big concerns here is Taiwan. You recently visited Yonaguni, which is a Japanese island, of course, very close to Taiwan. What did you see there? What were your big takeaways? And what did it tell you about sort of the way that Japan is facing some of these regional challenges and risks?
So I think there are three challenges that are known. Obviously, there's a bunch of unknowns. One is what's happening right now in the South China Sea with the Philippines, which is why the trilateral we did was important, but also both Navy as well as Coast Guard cooperations. There's the Taiwan Straits, and then there's the 38th parallel, which you don't live far from. And so Taiwan is one, but I think it's not limited to a singular activity. And then it's a reorientation of Japan's kind of force structure to the Southwest Islands away from just kind of the northern areas of Japan. That's what I think it looks like.
That was VOA's Seoul bureau chief William Gallo talking with U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel.
In Sudan's second most populous city, the once thriving market has been all but destroyed by almost a year and a half of war. VOA gained rare access to the city and met residents who recalled its former glory as fighting raged in the capital, Khartoum, on the opposite bank of the Nile. Henry Wilkins takes us there.
Omdurman Market, the shopping hub for the Khartoum metropolitan area, is seen in March 2023, full of people and full of life. Fast forward to September 2024, total devastation, caused by almost 18 months of war in Sudan. Faris Mustafa fled the city when the war started. He's returning to the market for the first time.
In the past, it wasn't easy to be here because of the overcrowding. All the shops were open. All the shops were filled with goods. All our mothers and sisters were here. I mean, the Sudanese community gathered here. Honestly, the war has changed us Sudanese. It's a test from God.
هو امتحان صعب فالله المستعان وإن شاء الله الوضعية.
Since the war began in April 2023, the Sudanese government has barred entry to many international journalists. But in September, VOA gained rare access to Omdurman, which is now controlled by the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF. Gunfire and shelling can be heard directed towards positions in Khartoum, held by the opposing paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, less than 4 kilometres away. The owner of this cosmetics store declined to give his name, out of fear for his safety. He says shopkeepers were getting ready for a major holiday when the war broke out.
All of the shops were affected. The shooting and chaos started around 2 days before the festival of Eid. People were operating normally and had their Eid products ready to sell.
A year and a half later, analysts say Sudan's war is at a stalemate. Peace talks have repeatedly stalled. Rights groups and the US government accuse both sides of war crimes. Just across the River Nile from here is RSF-controlled territory, which is inaccessible to most journalists. Those who have escaped say the destruction there is even worse. The UN says the territory is likely suffering from famine, the world's first in 7 years. But it's unable to confirm it due to lack of access. Mustafa says he just wants the war to end and life to return to normal for the people of Sudan.
May God compensate them, and people should not despair. God willing, one day we will return, and we will rebuild our country and rebuild Sudan, God willing.
Many civilians VOA spoke to shared this hope. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Omdurman, Sudan.
Thailand's king has endorsed a marriage equality bill passed by parliament earlier this year, officially making the kingdom the first country in Southeast Asia and the third place in Asia to recognize marriages of same-sex couples. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan has this story for us.
Scenes of celebration on the streets of Bangkok on Wednesday after Thailand approved a marriage equality law. It's the culmination of 2 decades of work by activists, work that won the royal endorsement of Thailand's king on Tuesday night. It officially makes the kingdom the first country in Southeast Asia to recognise same-sex marriage, some of those celebrating expressed relief and newfound feelings of security.
Finally, this is official. Even though it's something that humans should inherently have, we just feel relieved more than anything. I believe that many people who have fought for this have experienced a wide range of emotions, stress, intensity, or joy as they waited. There have been many feelings from the beginning up until this very moment.
Thailand, one of Asia's most popular tourist destinations, is already known for its LGBT culture and tolerance. The bill will come into force in January.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan.
And finally...
Hi, my name is Cindy Limavundla, and I'm the bicycle mayor of Cape Town.
As he guided young girls on their bikes through a street in Cape Town's Khayelitsha Township, he said he had one goal, to get more of them into cycling.
Majority of girls in the township, they are not given much sport options, and we have always seen that bicycle has the potential of changing lives.
He started an academy to do just that. And students of the academy, some of who had to walk kilometers to get to their school, say it has.
It's very rare to see girls cycling, so I saw an opportunity of a lifetime. Girls cycling here in Khayelitsha is one of the best things. We're encouraging more girls to do cycling, encouraging more girls to be more involved in cycling, and I believe that we're doing history for our township, Khayelitsha. We're doing history for Cape Town, and we're doing history for South Africa.
And Mavuna says it is growing.
We have seen so much difference in the community, the impact that we have made to young girls in the township, and we have an influx of other girls that want to come and ride.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, with Alexis Strope, I'm Scott Walterman.